Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download the latest podcast from CelticUnderground.net. On the blind side and down the back ways, you need to serve us call. When you can't get what you need, you feel like taking a toss to it all. I hope you enjoyed last week's guest of Hugh MacDonald, and this week's guest's chat I found equally interesting. Last week with Hugh MacDonald, it was all about sports writing and Celtic. This week, it's about music and Celtic with James Grant of Love and Money fame. And listen now how he manages to name drop Michael Jackson and Van Halen in the one story. Anyway, not going to ramble on too much at the beginning. I'll leave it all for the podcast. The only thing I will do is have my usual plug for the Celtic FC Foundation. In the last week, we have had the anniversary of the formation of our club, and so many people did things that were connected to the cornerstone of why we were founded. With those, the Green Brigades food bank collection, there was the Celtic Grave Society event for Patrick Gallagher, and there was the St Mary's anniversary mass on the Sunday. All fantastic things. So as you know, the Celtic FC Foundation have their annual Christmas fundraising going on at the moment. So whatever you can, we have the 100 or so fans sleeping out at Celtic Park on the 12th, that Saturday night. Find one of them on Twitter, make a contribution if you can. Go online to the Celtic FC Foundation, make a contribution to their campaign if you can. So I'm going to leave it to James Grant. Just one more thing, St Anthony of this parish has his Kenny Dalglish book coming out, and I'll give you a wee bit more information about that on the end of the podcast. I'm joined now by James Grant. James, how are you?
Good, thanks. Good.
Before we can get you on, you might have appeared on Celtic TV and done programmes for Celtic TV about music, but that's not good enough for us. We need you to prove your Celtic credentials.
Okay.
So, questions are, what was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
Memory's a bit foggy, but I used to live in Brighton and I was at the ground when Celtic paraded the European Cup on my dad's shoulders, and I'd have been four by that time, and I remember him taking me to a game at Shawfield, and I seem to remember it being a reserve game, but there was still I still recall a kind of frisson of excitement because Jimmy Johnston was playing,
right,
and it was pointed out to me,
mm-hmm,
it's Jimmy Johnston, and this is always stuck in my memory.
Which at that age you're like, good for me, good for you.
Well, no. I mean, I guess it was when you go back and look at things historically, like, you know, the Real Madrid, mm-hmm, game springs to mind, yeah, after, when 1968 or whatever, you just see how fantastic it was. But I was fortunate in that when I started going, it was a golden age, really, mm-hmm, of Celtic players. But the first sort of big game I can remember being at clearly was the 6-1 Scottish Cup final against Hibs.
Hibs, yeah.
And my dad always, for some reason, always took me to the Rangers end.
Mm-hmm.
Even at Parkhead, we always went to the Rangers end and kind of stood over to the left-hand side of the goal where there was a bit for Celtic,
right,
supporters,
yeah,
whatever. Just beside the rival support. I've no idea why I did it, but that was just our pitch. You know, when you used to stand,
so you could sneak back along to Brighton when you were
I don't know, maybe it was the quickest route to some boozer or whatever, I don't really know, but I think my dad thought as well, there'll be no bother because it's Celtic Hibs, but, and I haven't looked this up or anything like that, it was probably about 120,000 folk there, and I remember it being really violent, like loads of folk covered in blood,
right,
all the rest of it, and bottles raining down. Mm-hmm. And these were the days of the Kung Fu stars and the terraces and stuff like that. And I remember being really scared. And also a lot of the goals were scored up the other end in that game.
Which at Hampden is a million miles away.
It was. You had a vague idea that something was happening, and you could hear the crowd at the other end respond before you did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only really when I got home and sort of saw it on the telly that you really see what was happening. I mean, it's so different going to a football match now.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like at Parkhead, if you're sitting in the middle up high, it's just amazing what you can actually see.
It's like one of my friends actually makes the comment that sometimes he thinks fans are a bit overly critical of players now because they have such a perfect view of the pitch that they complain about passes not being done. That actually the player on the park probably can't see that pass because you've just got such a perfect perspective.
Yeah, I can see why that might be the case. But in those days, I can remember being in the jungle at Parkhead and stuff like that, and you really couldn't see much
mm-hmm.
a lot of the time, but you were certainly part of the collective experience.
I remember being in the Rangers end at Celtic played Forest in 82 and I think collectively I maybe saw 15 minutes of the game.
Yeah, going back to what you were saying, your question, so Dixie Dean's got a hat trick mm-hmm. that day, and he was, I mean, I loved Jimmy Johnston. I think everybody just, if you were born into supporting Celtic, you just loved Jimmy Johnston. But my hero in those days was Dixie Deans, who's probably not regarded as a Celtic great or whatever, mm-hmm. but I know he was a great header of the ball and liked scoring hat-tricks against Hibs. But we liked him so much, we named our budgie after him. And budgie was green, white and gold. And I used to fly about all over the Dodd and shite in everybody's head and shit. But I used to have this wee bell as well. This is really pathetic, me sharing budgie stories on a Celtic podcast. But,
like, yeah, but it's got relevance because it's Dixie
Deans. Dixie score a goal and he would lob this wee bell into the corner. And when he died, he had the ball at his feet as well.
He went out with the boys.
Yes, yeah, went out with the boys.
My only Dixie Dean story was I went into his, I was the business I was working for at the time were dealing with his pub in Bayliston when he was selling it.
Right.
And two things I remember. One, he only wanted, in a business context, he only ever wanted to be called John, not Dixie.
Oh,
two, okay. There was pictures all over the pub of him wearing Celtic and Motherwell things. And the thing that struck me is as you walk in the door, it said, "No club colours allowed."
It's bizarre, because I'd have thought that was a big part of the getting a pub, in that your clientele, you'd want the folks full of Celtic supporters because they knew you were Dixie Deans.
Plus you're advertising the fact that you're Dixie Deans by having pictures on
yeah, but I can actually remember my dad taking me to Bobby Lennox at a pub in Ayrshire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we actually went there for our holidays back in the old days, and not that Ayrshire's a bad place or anything like that.
Well, down in Sulcoats, or?
You know what I mean. We went to Butlins for 3 years, uh-huh. but we actually went to Ayr for our holidays as well. So exotic. Half an hour down the road in the train. But I can remember him taking me to Bobby Lennox pub, and I got Bobby Lennox autograph. So I think, you know, a big part of having a pub, and they all had pubs. I've been in Harry Hood's pub in Castlemilk, I've been in Billy McNeil's pub, just off Vicky Road.
Right, starting to be a link here. I don't know whether the link's Celtic or the link's you going into pubs.
Well, this is it. Yeah, but the when we moved to Castlemilk, I was going in the days of the leftover as well, where mm-hmm. where you simply had to find a drunken man to lift you over, which is strange. Thinking back on it, but I would go down myself or with a couple of pals to games when I was like 12 years old
mm-hmm.
from Castlemilk on the bus, swathed in green and white.
So did you go quite regularly when you were young?
Seem to remember it was like the time of Kenny Dalglish. I only really went to home games. Mm-hmm. And I never went to Celtic Rangers games.
Yeah.
I suppose I was always warned of that by my dad.
I think a lot of people have that type of...
Yeah, just, I guess they just want you to be safe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that it would have been any different, really. Talking about the Hibs game, I've seen violence at games.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, I don't think it was particularly worse during Celtic Rangers games, although I wouldn't really know.
So, how did you... Obviously, you're into football when you're a young guy. Did your love of music emerge at roughly the same time as you were getting into football, or was there a bolt out of the blue, a St Paul on the Road to Damascus moment with music?
No. Not unusually for, like, a lot of boys from Castlemilk or whatever. I wanted to be a football player, and I was no bad.
Right.
You know, I was all right. I mean, I used to play until a few years ago. My knees finally packed up.
Where would you play?
Just fives.
Right.
Up at the pits, Townhead. Mm-hmm. But the captain of my school team was Jim McAnally.
Right, yeah.
Who left our school team and joined Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was his first contract.
Right, yeah.
And there were a couple of the guys in my school team went on to play for Morton.
Mm-hmm.
So we were a good team, and we regularly got into, like, semi-finals. Played
what
at
school
Rosebury,
was that?
St Margaret Mary's.
Right, yeah.
In Castlemilk. So for a long time, I wanted to be a football player. My dad used to work alongside Jim's dad in Tennent's as well, Archie. So we were good pals. That was primary and secondary. My primary was St Julie's, and we won the Castlemilk Cup. Why I should remember these things, it's really pathetic. But there you go. You never forget, do you?
But those of us who wanted to be footballers who never made it, we hang on to those dreams.
I still have nightmares about chances I've missed, even when I was like 14. But I was very much in the Ted McMinn mould as a football player, like exceptional one game in 17 and like really average like the rest of the time. But you know, there'll be one or two games a season when I would score like six and you couldn't get the ball off me. Unfortunately, I was inconsistent, but I think also I've always been built like a stick insect. And when I got to like 15, 16, things started to get a lot more physical.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a guy that I couldn't dish it out, you know. It just wasn't in me.
Mm-hmm.
He like put the boot in, and if I got hot, I stayed hot, you know. So if somebody crunched me in the first 10 minutes, I lost my love of football, really. And I suppose since the age of about 11, 12, I'd started playing guitar and writing songs. And that had kind of grown and grown and grown until eventually I took down my Kenny Dalglish poster and put up one of Jimmy Page with a double neck guitar.
Right. So were you doing band stuff when you were at school?
No, really. Again, it's a long and it's a strange story. There was a Woolworths in Castlemilk, and I was looking at a Led Zeppelin album and the records, and the guy who was working behind the counter said, "You like Led Zeppelin?" And it was one of these, "Yeah, do you play a bit?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I play a bit. Do you fancy a jam?" I'm like, "Yeah, cool." And I went down to see him like 2 weeks later, and the Woolworths had shut down. And then it wasn't until like a year later I met the guy in the street, and he said, "I've been looking for you for a long time. Do you still fancy a jam?" And he lived in Cathcart, I lived in Castlemilk, and then we formed a band together. He was called Ian Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it had been about 16 and a half, but even admitting this because it's not what I tell my kids, but I left school at 15 and a half with no qualifications whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the dole for quite some time, and it was brilliant actually, because I didn't waste my time.
So it's been about 79, 80, something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, we just basically got together and played music pretty much every day. But then I had to do a YOP scheme.
Mm-hmm. You need to explain that for people under the age of about 40.
Yeah, it's a youth unemployment scheme, and it was in the job centre at Rutherglen, and it said young people wanted to act and play guitar for a YOP scheme, and I went and I auditioned. The acting part didn't really appeal to me. I was quite shy.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it, and it was amazing. There were a few luminaries from the group. We were in the Washington Street Arts Centre, just down at Anderson, and the most famous person that was in the group was Blythe Duff, who was in
Tiger. Yeah,
But you know, Harry from Hipsway, another few folk. One of the guys was in the Bill, a guy called David O'Hara, who was Mel Gibson's sidekick in Braveheart. So mm-hmm. people, actually, you know, it did work to a degree. And I suppose after that, I found myself writing music for plays, mm-hmm. stuff like that. That was part of the thing. I did a bit of acting, and in fact, I got an Equity card. After that, I auditioned for a job where I was playing the part of a drunken musician. Some days I still feel like I am. But I was a shite actor, really I was. I think I was quite good when I was playing people who weren't like me, but most of this role was just basically a young guy from a scheme, and mm-hmm. I don't think I was very good at it, but I think I got the gig because I could play the guitar.
So, and I'll touch on, you mentioned there the people who then went on to a bit of fame, and I'll touch on the music scene of the 80s in Scotland in a moment, but to keep with you, so the first sort of band you were in that had any sort of fame, as far as I know, it was Friends Again.
That's right, huh?
So how'd you get gigs? How'd you start off, get the gigs, and then how'd you get the record contract?
Well,
because today people can go and busk in the street and go and record something themselves straight away. So it's a bit different.
Yeah, it was really different, and it was still, the idea of getting a record contract ever was like science fiction, you know, it really was, especially if you were from Castlemilk or whatever. We were fortunate in that we were in the right place at the right time. The fact that so many bands were having success in Glasgow put a kind of spotlight on it. If you think of Manchester and the sort of Stone Roses, Happy Mondays era, that was Glasgow at this time. We had Simple Minds, we had Altered Images, we had the whole postcard thing, we saw Orange Juice, Aztec Camera. And Friends Again, we met up in the Regano, that was our first meeting. And I'd gone along, and then I went and auditioned. And I remember thinking, I can't, the whole kind of thing, in Glasgow at that time was very sort of jangly and a bit sort of DIY, and I was pretty good, mm-hmm. so I had to dumb down a bit. You know, I remember
down about Lawrence Donegan's level, down about
not quite that low, but I remember Chris playing Sweet Jane and me kind of footing about, and they never actually said you're in the band or whatever. It was like, well, we go and get some sweeties, and we went down to the shops in Bothwell. There was talk of us doing a gig supporting the Cuban Heels in London, and I was hugely excited by that. You know, mm-hmm. this wasn't like, they were serious about maybe getting deals. None of us really knew how to do that. So we put together some money and made a demo, two songs, Honey at the Core and Sunkissed, and basically that demo, remember Billy Sloan playing it, and that was the first time we played in the radio, and we were all jumping about. somebody's kitchen. It was just, it was like a really magical moment. And there was a guy called Dave Scott, who was Ents convener at Strathclyde. He took her tape down to London and played it to a guy in a publishing company, and it, that was where it all kicked off. One thing led to another. 2 months later with the publishing deal, and we were signed to Phonogram. It was unbelievable. But I should stipulate, you know, for about 2 years we were on 50 quid a week.
Mm-hmm.
That was our wage, you know. And I sometimes do a bit of lecturing, teach a bit of songwriting, and I can remember a wee guy, when I'm talking about this, I kind of talk about my career and say it was the happiest time of my life, and this wee guy said, I get more than that working in Tesco. I said, I think you're missing the point.
Uh-huh.
Do you love working in Tesco? Because this was amazing. I was playing gigs every night. We were in the back of a transit touring the country, but it was just fantastic. I mean, I still think in those days is the absolute best.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, for you coming on, I went on YouTube to refresh myself with Friends Again songs. And what got me was, a few bob was spent on your on one of your videos.
I don't know which one you'd be referring to. Maybe State of Art.
Well, put it this way, it wasn't, you went into a room and there was a black curtain and you just played in front of it.
The more money was spent probably when it became Love and Money, you know, that we really did spend an awful lot of money. On Love and Money, but Friends Again, we only made one video, I think, for State of Art, which is,
yeah, it was State of Art, yeah.
Yeah, it's still, I think it must have cost about 25 grand at the time, which doesn't seem that much in reflection. I remember it was filmed somewhere in Milton Keynes.
Looks more glamorous than Milton Keynes, that's what threw me.
Yeah, there were kind of ship funnels and stuff like that, and there were some glamorous kind of women hanging about. None of us could buck up the courage to even talk to.
So how did that end, and then Love and Money come around?
Oddly, I was really friendly with the guys in Hipsway. They were just my mates, like Skin and Harry, and we jumped about together all the time. We were mm-hmm. in clubs every night of the week. It was like Fury Murray's, Bennett's, Henry Africa's, Sub Club.
Anybody of my age is now just tripped back into them.
Yeah, it was like within a kind of quarter of a mile.
Yeah, 10
Maestro's.
Yeah.
But, you know, just all these places. And we were out all the time, so. And they were doing some demos, and it was, they just basically asked me to sing some backing vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never had a lot of confidence in my voice. But when we did it, it was that, you mentioned the word epiphany
mm-hmm.
earlier on, and there was a kind of moment where they were all like, you're really good. And I was like, yeah. And even like the engineer or whatever who was there at the time, it seemed to work when I sang, and I thought, you know what, I can do this. And I was having more influence in Friends Again, and I think it just seemed like the logical.
This is going to sound, I'm not a musician, so you just, like probably most people listening to this, you sing in the car when you're listening to the radio, whatever. You're softly spoken, but your singing voice isn't like that. So how do you arrive at that singing voice? Did it come naturally, or did you try different things? I mean, obviously, you again, the other question is, how do you, when you've mentioned you're shy, you weren't the singer on Friends Again, so how do you become that guy who's the lead singer and find your right voice?
I'm not shy as such, as I suppose I was sort of a mixture, almost in a kind of bipolar way. I was sometimes shy, sometimes arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
I was certainly confident in my ability as a musician,
mm-hmm.
not as a vocalist, you know, and not. But that's a really common thing among singers. I mean, I know, for example, like we work with a guy who produced Steely Dan, and I know that Donald Fagen, Steely Dan singer, hated his own voice.
Right.
Hated it. And there were many years I was quite uncomfortable with my own voice. That's not to say I didn't think I could sing or mm-hmm. I was a good performer. I'm a lot more comfortable with my voice now. You know, I think I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
If you like, you know, it's probably taken me like 30 years to be able to say that.
But you didn't have to do any sort of trial and error of this is the pitch I sing, it just comes naturally? Or?
I suppose I'm, technically speaking, I'm a baritone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, for a lot of singers really, it's like, we were speaking earlier on about your Celtic, it's like in your blood, or osmosis, or the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you're listening to, so you start singing like your heroes. You don't, much is made sometimes about people singing in American accents, but that, I didn't grow up listening to Jimmy Shand, you know. Mm-hmm. Grew up listening to Slade, Sweet, Stones, Led Zeppelin, so that was how I sang. You know, you sing like what you hear. And I suppose that's how it was formulated. It wasn't affected, if you like.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're with, because one of the things that it strikes me is that, you know, to be signed up with Phonogram, you're signed up with a pretty decent record label. So did the Love and Money being on Phonogram, did that just sort of evolve out of Friends Again being on it?
Yeah, pretty much. But I've been doing a number of interviews lately. We've been kind of talking about the same thing, but when Friends Again split up, I'd never doubted for a second that I would get another record deal.
Right.
It just never entered my mind. And when I think back on that now, I'd kind of like to hang about with that young guy who felt like that, or maybe be him, you mm-hmm. know, because I just feel like that's another human being, you know.
From what you were saying, you were just really good at what you did. You knew you were really good at what you did, and therefore that just
it never entered my mind for one second that I wouldn't get another record deal. I just thought, I'm going to go and get another record deal, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose so. I was backed up by my actions, but to be so, I mean, I was an arrogant prick, but, you know, to be so confident, it's just extraordinary now. Especially when I think of the songs that were written, it wasn't like they were blown in the wind or anything like that, you know. But
do you think it was part of, you mentioned the Glasgow scene and you mentioned some of the bands there, and that taken a note of the bands who were kicking around at that time, the sort of mid to late 80s in Glasgow, that if you're part of a scene which in itself is being perceived as being elevated up to a premier level of the music business, that helps?
I was certainly regarded as a player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think even by people in London at that point, you know, if I didn't get a deal with Phonogram, I'd have got a deal with someone else. I knew that. And other people had said to me, do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? I'd been asked to join other bands. So, I suppose I could back it up. I had the talent, you know.
And talking of other bands, Andy Taylor produced Candy Bar Express, is that
right? That's right, yeah. It's weird because at the time Duran Duran were seen as really cheesy and shit, although they were massive. Now they're sort of regarded as being quite trendy and mm-hmm. quite cool.
As a young male, I would never have bought a Duran Duran record during that time.
Me neither.
But I would have bought A Love and Money, but I did buy A Love and Money.
Well, I suppose the point, it was a weird situation because it caused a sort of dichotomy in what I was doing. I'd made a record with a guy that used to run the Sub Club, called Graham Wilson. I wrote this song called Candy Bar Express, and it was going to be released in an independent label.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent a record company a copy, and it was one of these things. Sounds really, really unlikely, but it happened. Andy Taylor heard it. He was looking for something to produce. Do we want to work with Andy Taylor? The initial response was no. And then everyone, really all my friends, Graham at the time included, was just like, you'd be crazy not to do this. You know, you really should go and do it. It did turn out to be a bit of an albatross around our necks,
mm-hmm.
third degree, because I think it was seen as really uncool, whatever. But I suppose the way I saw it at the time was, not only will I get my foot in the door here, I'll kick the door down,
mm-hmm.
You know, it would just blow off its hinges. And I still actually, I really, really like the record.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of everything else peripheral to that, I think he did a really good job. And I still think it sounds really, really good. And it was kind of the time of the power station.
Yep.
And that. So we went down and we were recording in Ayr in London for a fortnight, Ayr Studios. And then we mixed it in New York for a week. And it was just, I mean, I can't remember what age it was, 23, something like that. It was mental.
But that's an amazing time. I mean, what places did you go in the world at that time? You must have gone everywhere then, if you're London, New York.
All over the shop, really. I suppose that when we made a video for Candy Bar Express, again, you know, you're talking about money spent in videos, so we shot it in the Mojave Desert in California, and we were driving along the freeway, and it was like we could see something up ahead, and it gradually dawned on us, we were like, fucking hell, it's like a 60-foot sign that said Love and Money. That had been erected in the middle of the desert.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like, Jesus Christ, this is mental. So, yeah, it was absolutely mad. We shot another video in Tokyo, which I can remember also. At the time, this was going to be the first single for our second album, Hallelujah Man. And usually when you're doing videos, you get sent 5 scripts, whatever. They were all shite. But at the top, it's like anything else, it would say location. So you're kind of flicking through the scripts and you're like, ah, interesting. Tokyo. You know, it was a load of shite, the actual script,
yeah.
Or whatever, but you're thinking, that'd be quite good, Tokyo. So we're having a kind of conversation with two of the guys in the marketing department. We were waiting for the head of A&R to come in. Guy David Bates, and I was saying, the one in Tokyo looks interesting, and this guy Nick said, you know, I think we really need to be careful that people don't think you're too hyped. And I'm like, good point. And then David Bates walks into the room. David Bates is a legendary figure, you know, like a satin Dire Straits tour jacket on, aviator glasses, sits down in the middle of the room and says, right, we're going to fucking Tokyo. And that was it. It's like a scene from Kill Your Friends or whatever. It was just unbelievable.
Your point earlier about having Andy Taylor, and is it too commercial or not trendy enough, were you comfortable with all that commercial stuff of, like, we're going to Tokyo, apart from obviously being in Tokyo?
What do you say, you know, when you're in that position? What do you, you know, I wasn't like thinking, no, I don't want to go to Tokyo. There's another shoot here in Watford, you know, that looks really good. And I just thought, fucking hell. And I'm phoning up my girlfriend saying, I'm no see you for a couple of weeks, I'm away to Tokyo. You know, I mean, it was bonkers thinking back, you know. We were out in LA a lot, we toured America, toured all over Europe. Mm-hmm. It was really brilliant. But, you know, like, during the year of that record's release, we were exhausted. You know, we toured for 8 months. And I mean, it was amazing, don't get me wrong, you know, it was absolutely brilliant and really exciting, but it was quite difficult as well, you know.
So you must have been on life, some TV performances. What was the sort of weirdest and what was the sort of best TV that you did during that time?
The game changer was Wogan, really.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because we were on Wogan with Strange Kind of Love, and I think we were the first band that wasn't top 40 that did Wogan, and something like 17, 18 million people watched it. It's just unbelievable. No, you're just on there miming, but it really was a game changer because we'd been touring at the time and we'd been doing okay. You're playing to maybe 300-400 people a night, mm-hmm. up and down the country. Pretty much in the space of a couple of weeks, it became 1,000, 2,000, and I mean, you're viewing it all with a weather eye as well, because there are all these folk with tears in their eyes singing every lyric, and you're like, where the fuck were you 2 months ago? You know, it's quite, it's mm-hmm. funny as well. And also the first six rows of any gig would be guys with quiffs and spotty shirts, because I had a spotty shirt on in the Hallelujah Man video, and we obviously thought this was hilarious. You know, I would get slagged to death with the rest of the band, quite rightly so, but it wasn't like I was trying to make any kind of statement. I think I only really wore a spotty shirt. There was probably a historical context. I remember Bob Dylan wearing a spotty shirt when he did his first Electric gig. And I thought, well, for anyone that cares about such shit, they might get some kind of...
You appear to have a bit of self-awareness then. Do you think that helps you through the madness of
yeah, absolutely, because there's no question that you meet a phenomenal amount of arseholes. Right. You know, in the music business, and I went out my way not to become like one of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, undoubtedly I fell short of that on occasion, but
I often think this when people decry, or use an extreme example, Robbie Williams. I'm not a Robbie Williams fan, but I do think if from 17 years of age or thereabouts everybody's telling you you're brilliant and wonderful, it would actually be a strange individual by the time he's 37 who isn't a bit of a knob.
I kind of think you're right. I think the seeds of his, I mean, he seems quite mad, actually, quite mad, Robbie Williams, quite like scary. Mm-hmm. I quite like some of his records, you know, I think he's tried to be an artist as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe not. Maybe his material hasn't matched up or whatever, but I think he's actually tried to be an artist. And he seems quite a bonkers guy. So I quite like Robbie Williams. I appreciate what you're saying. Andy Taylor definitely hadn't grown up.
Right.
He had not grown up properly, because I think he'd been... You know, if you like, I had served my trade. Mm-hmm. I'd done years in the back of a transit loading our own gear,
yeah.
and all the gigs, and at the end of the gig loading it back up again, you know, stopping for a piss at the side of the motorway up and down the country, you know, just I'd done all that shit. So like when a bit of success came, we relished it, and I don't think we took it for granted either, mm-hmm. or took it entirely seriously, you know. When we went abroad, we would sometimes do TVs and swap instruments, that kind of thing, just for a laugh, you know. But you do realise also, I think, when you in the course of doing all this, that Spinal Tap's absolute bible. I know it's one of the funniest films ever yeah. made, but if you're a musician, some parts get less funny.
Because I'm too real.
Yeah, the whole kind of... I thought you said we were on before the puppets. That kind of shit, you know.
One other thing, just when you mentioned the Wogan thing there, that's always struck me, and we've had a couple of musicians on, they never asked, it's always struck me about miming. So you talked earlier about the acting bit and you weren't comfortable acting. Surely miming is the ultimate acting that a musician has to do.
Yeah, what you were always told was to sing.
Right.
To actually sing, you know, don't just mouth the words. And that's, I was always shite at it. I was always, I think if you looked at the footage, it would be evidential that I was shite at it. It was just part of your job. He was very nice, actually, your man, Terry Wogan.
Was he?
And there were a couple of folk that you met in the course of, I remember meeting Tom O'Connor. Mm-hmm. And I'd never. These are just like faces in your life. I grew up in Castlemore. Telly was always on. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like everyone would sit down and watch the Generation Game on a Saturday night. You know, and I never particularly liked Tom O'Connor, but he was so nice. Mm-hmm. He actually taking the time, and you just thought, "Fuck, fair play to you." That was the same as Terry Wogan. He came into our dressing room. And he's like, "You's all right, lads." And then had a bit of a chat, and you think, fair play.
I suppose if you're the right type of human being, you remember that no matter how bold and brazen you appear to be, your first occasion of doing something like that, you'd be really nervous.
Yeah, I remember Billy Whitelaw being on it as well. We all thought Billy Whitelaw was fantastic, you know. She is a legend. And it was really funny because we used to have this stock phrase. You would go to nightclubs and you thought it was your God-given fucking right to get in for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in a band.
Yeah.
And at that night, we went to the Wag Club in Soho. And I was tasked with the phrase. This was the phrase. I don't know if this means anything. But that was what you said. What a pricky. No, but it was be like, I don't know if this means anything, but we're loving money and we just did Wogan tonight. And it was like, come in, sir. You know.
Do you know, the reason I'm people listening to this won't know, I'm cringing listening to this story because one of my mates...
I'm cringing as well, incidentally.
But for much lesser level, one of my mates ran a couple of nights in Fury Murray's in the sub club, and if you ran a club in one of those, you felt you had the right to walk past every queue.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, can remember going to Fury Murray's, and he just split up with, it was actually his girlfriend ran the Fury Murray's one, and he just split up with her, and there was a massive queue at Fury Murray's, and he was saying, come on in. I was like, no, I didn't want to. And he said, no, it's fine. And he walked right up, and whoever was on the door was like, I've no idea who you are. And we had to walk back the line to the queue. So even to this day, I can still remember thinking, I told you, I didn't want to do it.
There were times where you were like, I don't know if this means anything, but... And people would be like, no, I'm afraid it doesn't mean anything. I'm like, all right, where do I pay?
And was... What was the biggest gig you did?
Supporting you two at Murrayfield.
Mm-hmm.
That was big. And I remember that we were going through from Glasgow to Edinburgh, and none of us said a word at all.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, if I speak, I'm going to be sick. It was like the most nervous I've ever been. It was just the idea of making a prick of yourself on a really grand scale,
mm-hmm,
in front of like 50,000 punters. It was quite terrifying. Somebody actually lobbed a ball on stage, and I tried to kick it or show a bit of skill. Sadly, it was one of my off days.
One of your 16 out of 17.
it was a bizarre gig as well, because Run Rig were on before us, and I'm not going to slag anybody off or anything like that. I just didn't especially like Run Rag ever. Although I like them all as people, the people I've met, like Donnie Monroe and all that. Anyway, we were like, this band Run Rag are on before us, you know, fuck, that'll be pish, we'll be fine. They got the entire ground singing along with Loch Lomond just before we come on. You're like, shit, they're actually going down really well. The Mission were on after us, and then the Pogues, then you too.
It's almost like a mini festival.
Yeah, it kind of was. We played another gig in Friends again, where the Pogues supported us in London. And fucking blew us off the stage. They were absolutely mental.
Mm-hmm.
And the crowd went bananas. And then we came on and kind of did our jangly pop and emptied the place pretty much.
Did you get to meet you two?
No.
No?
No. I mean, I guess we could have. Again, that's not... It just was never my thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really... I don't know, I guess it would have been quite nice to kind of go down and say hello. Maybe, you know, now I would maybe think about doing that in the light of experience or whatever, but, you know, at the time, I don't know, I was probably too up myself or whatever.
You really do seem like someone who wishes you could go back to your former self, have a bit of the confidence, but just take a bit of the edge off it.
I think it was... not uncommon, you know, with our younger selves, when your testicles are bigger but your brain is smaller, and you know, perhaps the reverse of that is true now.
Yeah.
You know, I think a happy medium could be sought, but I'm not one for regrets at all. Mm-hmm. I don't think I think we had some incredible experiences. I still do have incredible experiences, you know. My last gig was just about a month ago in the City Halls, and played that with like a 14-piece orchestra, and it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there are still things that move me. You know, I'm very fortunate to do something I love.
So how did Love and Money come to an end?
I just sort of felt like I was dragging everyone through the mire, the morass of my subconscious torments for too long at this kind of time. You know, I think kind of way I was maybe wanting to go at the time was more left field and...
Mm-hmm.
It just felt like the right thing to do. I was writing music for a film. My wife was pregnant with her first kid, and it just felt like it was time to move on.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a good decision for us all.
Right.
We got together again a couple of years ago and did some shows, and that was really, really good fun. It was like being back in the gang hut again. Mm-hmm. But what I don't have any desire to make that a permanent thing, or need to make it a permanent thing. I can kind of do it all, if you like, off my own back. I mean, they're all my songs anyway, you know.
And I've noticed of late, I mean, I was at one of your gigs when you reformed. And I've noticed of late there's been, we talked about the Scottish bands, there's been a number of people who've started playing again.
Yes.
Saw Lloyd Cole at the Bandstand, he didn't invite Lawrence along. And Delamitri supported, Justin Curry supported him. And obviously you guys and Hipsway, you mentioned Hipsway. That's Hipsway, right. Are playing, is it this Saturday?
Yeah, I think it is. It's next weekend.
Oh, is it next weekend?
Yeah, I've got a couple of shows.
It's
otherwise,
next weekend. Yeah.
Otherwise, I would have gone. I'm playing as well, but the I think it's.
Do you think it's people have just reached a point in their life and they think, do you know what, I'm just comfortable doing.
To a degree. I mean, for me, what it was when you have a solo career, you And I think this is true of, it's not just me, it would be true of Justin, Lloyd, whoever, that you drive away from what you were necessarily. You know, you want to, you want to say that was then, this is now. And I think it's a difficult time because it really is like starting again. You know, you think everyone's going to go with you, but that's not. If Justin played in Glasgow tonight, for example, he would draw a good crowd. If Del Amitri played,
yeah,
and that's the way it works. You know, everybody knows Love and Money is me.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, if I played in Glasgow, you know, okay, I drew 1,000 punters the other week, but Love and Money could draw 3-4 times that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this I know.
Yeah.
But I did. People would shout for Candy Bar Express during solo gigs, and I would get really uppity.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them, fuck off, leave me alone, you know, like, I've moved on, whatever. Sometimes it was more ferocious than that. Then I did a number of shows at the City Halls, and it was like recital rooms, and one of the nights I'd asked the audience to choose the songs, and they chose like 85% of Money songs, and I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I met up with a mate for a pint afterwards, and he said, you look like you were having a fucking great time. And I thought, you know, I was. And he's like, would it be so bad to do a few of Money songs, to do a bit more, to do a gig? I thought, no, I wouldn't. You're right. So I guess it's that sort of coming to terms with your past, and you know, I wrote all these songs, and some of them are funky, some of them are different. You know, I was into different things at those times. You know, but I'm more reconciled with that. I'm more comfortable with the whole thing now.
You don't get the guy from Toto to come on stage when you're playing Strange Kind of Love or anything like that.
Well, it'd be difficult because he died like 15 years ago, but. He was amazing, incidentally, Jeff. He was absolutely fantastic. He'd played in Thriller. He tells a great story, or he told a great story, where when he was recording the drums for Beat It, all the musicians, it was like Eddie Van Halen, Greg Fillinganes, all these folk, Jeff Beccaro, they were all in a big circle, and Michael Jackson's like, let's have some drums. And like, Jeff started the beat, and then it's like, Eddie, some guitar. So Eddie Van Halen fires in with the guitar, and all the while Michael Jackson's like spinning, doing the moonwalk, and singing. And Jeff just said it was extraordinary. It was utterly mind-blowing. Never seen a performer like him. Yeah, I'm thinking, fuck, to have been in that room.
Yeah,
you know. But he was a really, really great, great guy, Jeff. Again, you know what I say, you meet so many fucking arseholes in the music business. When you meet someone who you admire, who is nice and down to earth and likes a laugh and a pint, and you know, you just think, it's brilliant.
Who's the best person you played with? Ignoring the arseholes then, let's talk positively. Who's the best person you played with? Maybe not in terms of best, most accomplished, but best in terms of it was just great playing with them.
Jeff was really brilliant. There were a couple of times Donald Fagen did a number of wee things on Strange Kind of Love, Steely Dan, and I guess that's one of these moments that you do think, Jesus, this is mental. Mm-hmm. That's the guy from Steely Dan.
Yep.
There was one of the guys from the Eagles come in to sing on Jocelyn Square, and when he was doing it, it was quite high what he was singing. It was sort of falsetto, and we were saying to Gary Katz, who was producing the record at the time, can you ask him to make it a bit less BG? He's like, I can't fucking say that to the guy. He's one of the fucking Eagles. You know, but you are like, think of another way of saying it then. But can still hear it a wee bit BG now, but I do love the BG, so that's cool.
Did you ever live in Jocelyn Square?
I didn't, but I used to pass it in the 37 bus from Castlemilk. So the 37 bus went through when I was getting into town. I just passed this place, so Jocelyn Square, and it was beside the mortuary.
Mm-hmm.
And I just always thought it was a beautiful name for such a miserable looking place. And it just stuck in my mind. And I can remember the day I wrote it. We were in a rehearsal room in Maryhill.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just mucking about, and it came together.
So what are you up to now?
Well, I just released a live album of, it's called James Gant and Halloway Strings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I've been doing a number of shows with my own sort of bespoke orchestra, which is sort of like a greatest hits, a kind of mixture of my solo stuff, Love and Money stuff. And more recently, in the last couple of weeks, there's another project just come out, which is very different, which is, I suppose, revisiting the young me. It's like a disco dance project where I sing 90% of the stuff falsetto.
Mm-hmm.
It was born out of a sort of desire to find another voice and to do something else, something really different, left field from what I would normally do. So it's called Corvids. So we've got a single out this week actually called Bad Faith, and that's quite bonkers. I was not sure how people might perceive it. I'm still not. But I remember tweeting earlier this year that if Bowie taught us one thing, it was to be brave, to trust ourselves, don't be afraid of failure. And I thought, you know what, I should fucking take my own advice.
So is that on iTunes? Or?
It is, yeah.
You've got a SoundCloud account as well, have you put it on that? No?
It's not on my SoundCloud, but if you follow me on Twitter or Facebook, it's on my timeline, you know, you can listen to it through them.
So you getting to many Celtic games?
No.
Under the blessed Brendan?
I really like the way the team is playing. The last Celtic game, the last actual game I was at was the Inter Milan game.
Right.
Which was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
A really great night. The whole kind of Ronnie Dela project didn't really work for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really worked for most people. What seems to be happening now is genuinely, I think, I'm not a diehard or whatever. I'm a Celtic supporter. I'm not a season ticket holder. Unfortunately, years where I've chosen to buy a season ticket have been like the Liam Brady era,
when
we were signing Mike Galloway. Actually, the last time I was going really regularly was Mark Maneil.
Right.
Kind of time. And that was brilliant because mm-hmm. we had a guy called Henrik Larsson playing that. I'm sure you've had this conversation a gazillion times, but tears start welling up when people start talking about Henrik Larsson. He was truly a superstar. And we were really lucky to have him.
You said something similar to Hugh McDonald, who was on last week, said about Jimmy Johnson. It's a given that everybody liked Jimmy Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
So when you're choosing your favourite Celtic player, it's almost, well, obviously it's Jimmy. So I'm actually picking my second favourite because it's a given that it's Jimmy. And I would say it's the same with Henrik Larsson for people of the last 20 years. It's a given that it would be Henrik. So when you're asking people, they're probably choosing, well, Henrik apart, who would it be?
Yeah, I mean, Henrik's my favourite Celtic player. You know, I saw Jimmy Johnston and I loved Jimmy Johnston, mm-hmm. but that's it was like Ur Wally or whatever, you know. Everybody loved Jimmy Johnston, like yep. you say. The other thing, the big person at that time was Dalglish. But I seem to remember Dalglish got pelters from factions of the Celtic support who perhaps thought he was a bit too svelte or namby-pamby, you know, like for Celtic, and they were all greeting into their shandies when he left. But I recall him getting pelters at the time.
I also recall him always getting pelters for Scotland after he left Celtic.
He wasn't great for Scotland.
People regularly used to say, I remember the media debating whether to drop him because he would never put his Liverpool performances into the Scotland team.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not like he wasn't trying. I don't really understand it. But how are you not going to play a guy like that?
Yeah.
I mean, Scotland's one of Scotland's only truly world-class footballers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, when he left Celtic, he was much better. With Liverpool, he was extraordinary. His talent went on to a different level altogether. You know, he was a world-class player. And I like that because, you know, history views that favourably in that he played for Celtic.
Yeah.
He was a world-class player. Same with Henrik Larsson. He went on and won a European Cup winner's medal, and he affected that game. And without him, that medal wouldn't have been won.
He was at his peak at Celtic, and he was not at his peak.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't.
Not saying he wasn't great, but he's a wee bit older.
But he's adored. He is adored at Barcelona as well. He's adored everywhere. He's adored in Manchester because he's just, it's the way he carries himself. He's a superstar. People talk about just having him there to train was unbelievable because he's just a fucking animal at training. But going back to what we were talking about, like, I feel that Celtic are genuinely maybe two players short of being a really, really excellent football team. Some of the buys, the recruiting has been absolutely fantastic. Sinclair and Dembele, unbelievable.
We were saying this, stick two midfielders of the standard of Sinclair and Dembele into that team and we are a last 16 Champions League team.
Absolutely agree with you. You know, I think a really good creative midfielder would even might edge it, you know, maybe another defender. I just think that they're two players short of being a really good team, a really proper good team, and it's been many years since we could say that.
Your only fear is we get, in terms of the standard of last 16, the nature of the modern football, you have to accept Dembele came to Celtic because his agent, Brendan Rodgers has said this, thought it was too big a step to go straight from where he was to Spurs to top four England, so he came to Celtic as that stepping stone. So we just have to, he's not going to stay around, but you're just hopeful that if we get those two extra players in, he and Sinclair and Simonovic is looking like he's going to be a player. You're just hopeful that those people hang around for a year or two enough that we can actually get that team.
I think Armstrong's looking better as well. I think he's got better players around him, you know, and I think that's affecting them all really positively. Even you would maybe have said a year ago that Armstrong, it just wasn't Celtic class. Now he's really looking the part because he's got guys like Sinclair around him, Dembele, who really are. You're absolutely right. It's going to be difficult to hang on to a guy like that because he's got it all, you know. And we are no longer in the position where we can hold on to people. It's just the way, that's just the way it is.
You just want full value when he goes.
The best you can hope for is that, you know, if these guys stay at Celtic for 2 years, they'll achieve legendary status. You know, if we went into our last 16 with him and Sinclair, you know, it could be really extraordinary.
It's interesting you say the legendary status thing. I was fortunate enough to be at Celtic Park last week for the premiere of the DVD for the Lisbon Lions, and Brendan Rodgers was there with Chris Davies, and I was discussing with one of the guys as we were leaving. Obviously Brendan's a Celtic fan from birth, and Chris Davies isn't, but if I'm Brendan in the car on the way back, I'm going to be saying to him, see this club, see that 50 years down the line, that could be us. We could have immortality in the minds of hundreds of thousands, millions of people. That's what you can achieve here.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why people still get lachrymose when they're talking about Henrik Larsson over a beer. It's a special team, you know, it really is. I don't make any bones about it, you know.
So one final thing, you did a thing for Celtic TV.
I did, yes.
On Celtic songs.
I did.
How did that come about?
Somebody just asked me to do it, and I thought, why not? It was quite a good experience. It was quite funny because where Celtic TV was filmed is where Rangers TV is filmed, and there's a green table and a green wall and a blue wall and a Rangers table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as the Rangers table was there when I came into the studio, and I'm like, somebody having a laugh here. And it was like, you're against the blue wall at the moment. I'm thinking, okay, so it's a blue wall. Why would that upset anyone? You know, no, it's got to be the green wall. You know, it was an interesting programme. Mm-hmm. And I was asked to do it, and quite enjoyed the experience. I was reading off an autocue. It's one of these things you're kind of like, here we go, why not?
I enjoyed it and certainly I remember at the time lots of positive comment about it.
Oh, that's nice. You know, I'm glad. I'm proud to say that I support Celtic and all that. I'm not a diehard, and I'm not a paranoid Celtic supporter. Mm-hmm. I like it. I'll be on Twitter and all that, and I like a bit of a laugh, a bit of banter, but when it gets to levels of abuse or anything else, I'm just not interested. That's not why I'm on it.
Yeah.
You know, I like the collective experience type thing. If I'm not at a game, I quite enjoy being on Twitter when it's like a goal or a penalty and everybody shouts penalty. Pathetic as it might seem, you know, and my language is fucking atrocious on it, but there you go.
I was in this very office when we were playing, I can't remember which European game it was this season, whichever one it was, that we were 2-0 down and then made it 2-1, or 1-0 down and then made it 1 each, can't remember, but Griffith scored, and your communal experience thing, I was shouting and swearing, because all I was getting was negative people on Twitter saying how dreadful the Celtic performance was.
Yeah.
I was shouting at thin air, get it right fucking up you, when Celtic scored.
Well, this is it. I mean, I quite like it, or like on your timeline or whatever, when it's penalty, you know, and it's like everybody, it's like the best thing, next best thing to actually being at a game, you know. It's a good laugh, which is what I think it should be, you know.
So where can people see you perform next?
The next two gigs, well, I think they're both sold out in Hamilton and in Irvine.
Not even if they walk up to the front and say, I don't know.
I don't know if this means anything. No, it doesn't. Sorry. But I think it'll be next year before I was talking about myself in the third person there. I've got to be really careful. Before I do some more shows, probably April, May. And might try and do some more string shows, might even do a Corvids gig. I think I'm on doing a session for Janice Forsyth next week.
Right.
So a couple of wee things like that. But yeah, next year definitely I'll be out on the road again.
Okay, well, with that, I'm sure lots of people will be finding you on Twitter and to find out when those gigs are. And I'll say, James Grant, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, it's been a pleasure.
Take a ride on the sugar train. Take a ride on the sugar train.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast, and I know I'm biased, but I thought James Grant was an excellent guest. Anyway, there's fortunately proper football coming back soon, but before we get on to that, Stephen Murray of St Anthony fame has a book coming out on CQM Books, Kenny of the Celtic,
which is pretty much a book about Kenny Dalglish's career as a Celtic player, right up until the day when he left Celtic for Liverpool in 1977, breaking Stephen Bury's heart. He says actually in the blurb about the book, he was their hero, but ultimately their heartbreaker when he left for Celtic for Liverpool in 1977. For there, I think you can replace Stephen. I think he would admit that himself. You can go, and there'll be links on our site as to how you can buy the book at $14.99. Anyway, there'll be more excellent guests along soon. We'll be speaking to Stephen Murray. His book formally launches at Celtic Park this week, and we'll have some audio from that event. Anyway, enough of me. That was Jamie Grant with me, Harry Brady. There'll be links to James' Twitter, etc. on the site. And I'll leave you with Candy Bar Express.
Bow down to the sacred cow. You'll never know what you missed. Everybody say yeah, say thanks that songs like this exist. Be a junkie for love, be a sucker for success. You are the station on the Candy Bar Express. Take a ride on the sugar train. 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 Be a junkie for love. Be a sucker for success. Be a junkie for love. Be a sucker for success. Be a junkie for love.